On Sunday, April 30th at 11 p.m., Suge and My Bowl presents bassist, cellist, NEA Jazzmaster, and master of the glissando, Ron Carter. Join us as we discuss some of Ron Carter's career and hear as much as we can from his musical projects. That's Sunday, April 30th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suge and My Bowl is the name of the program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is bassist, cellist, composer, band leader, educator, and NEA Jazzmaster, Ron Carter. As we close out Jazz Appreciation Month, we're going to open the program in celebration of the close of National Poetry Month with a piece that Jane Cortez invited Ron Carter to join her on. This is in tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suge and My Bowl, starting now.
Things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Somewhere a woman is singing five different scales at the same time for every stingray bopping in the Savoy ballroom. She is singing Savoy, Savoy. This energy's coming from me. Savoy, Savoy. I'm sinking my soul in you. Savoy, Savoy. Oh, how my spirit dilates, how my silence pulsates in between these spaces in you, Savoy. Savoy, Savoy, Savoy. Somewhere a woman superimposing her supernatural nest of robins inside nature of singing Savoy instinctively takes possession of the moon, spins it forward from tune deck of incidental tunes, covers it with her scat allergy spittle, rolls it to the edge of her edge, and cuts up the space like the great space cutter she is, this woman singing Savoy, Savoy. And flying through porthole of her shipwreck, kicking in all the subversive signals she had suppressed in self-examination booth of ancestral tongues. This woman pushing back the romantic overgrown mangrove of you song books to step out with a Saturday night coup of riffs, everything lovely and sweet and lovely in her retrospective mouth of multiple time systems, mesmerizing and signifying to all the stingrays bopping in the Savoy ballroom. Savoy, 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 Savoy.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Ron Carter.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carter, for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I really appreciate your being on.
Pleasure for me to join you. Thank you.
I keep calling you Mr. Carter because that's all I know. Should I continue this?
Yes, it feels good over here.
Okay, then. Now, I first have to say that it was good seeing you last Wednesday, seeing Linda Mahon Oh at the Jazz Standard. It was a nice surprise.
Why?
Well, I didn't know you were going to be there. Who would know? No one knows your coming and goings but you.
It's nice to keep it mysterious a little bit, I think.
How did you first know about the gig?
Occasionally I pick up a newspaper, and it happened to be at the New York Times on the weekend. I had the acts in town I hadn't seen her play. And I'd seen her name in other ads and magazines and comings and goings, and I wanted to see what kind of band she had and how she saw the problems of the bass.
Yeah, well, I definitely enjoyed having her as a guest. She was our guest on this program on the 16th.
Okay. Wow, okay.
I'm not going to actually spend a lot of time talking about your upbringing, only because you've probably talked about it so much, and it's on what we have now, the Internet, and there's also the book, Ron Carter, Finding the Right Notes by Dan, could you pronounce his last name, please?
Ouellette, French, Canadian.
Ouellette.
Okay. Yes.
As I was able to see you at the Jazz Standard, I was grateful that you were able to autograph my first edition of this book. Thank you so much for that.
You're more than welcome.
When I got my copy, this book was not available, but it is now available as a second edition?
Third edition.
Third edition. All right. It can be obtained from your
favorite. Through Amazon.com.
That's it. I was just going to say your favorite book purchasing places, but that works too.
That'll work, yeah.
The person who had accompanied you had mentioned how the latest edition had more pictures in it?
There have been some corrections in the text. And they made one extra pictures, but my concern was that during the first time you publish a book like this type, no matter how much you proofread and have people proofread for you, when you do it again and a year later, you find stuff that's not inaccurate but not quite right. So we spent some time for this edition and the new one that's available, making some last-minute quote changes and some spellings were not quite right, I think, and just odds and ends that make the book now much more product that I'm really happy to carry on and read myself.
I actually was wondering about that. As I read the first edition, there were some things in there that I thought were, maybe it's just me. And I wondered whether you had looked at that edition, but you just addressed that right now.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for that. And also, at the time that I got my copy of Ron Carter, Finding the Right Notes by Dan Ouellette, it was from a source where it was a fan-funded project that didn't have many copies available. Were you familiar with how the...
I know who they were, and I'm not quite sure how the process worked. Actually, I expected them to do something other than what they ultimately did. I thought they were something other than a clearinghouse for orders. I thought they were more active in publicizing the book and doing the book parties, I guess book reading parties, those kind of events.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what they do. And ultimately, I decided that I would have a better chance of covering that kind of ground if I was, in fact, the owner of the book and publisher.
I see.
Well, I am both, and I'm having a fun time doing that.
Excellent. That is great. That's better news.
Thank you.
There is something I do want to mention about your upbringing. I believe you were born in Michigan. What is it, Ferndale?
Yes.
And then you moved to Rochester, New York.
No. I moved to Detroit after there.
Right. And now, where is it that, actually, how do I want to put this? Where was it that you received the misinformation that you could not make it as a European classical cello player?
The environment, the opportunities that should have been equally spread among those of us in the orchestra were not equally spread among those who were in the orchestra. And being able to add 2 and 2 is 4 for a very long time before I got to be 16, their 2 and 2 are 4 was different than my 2 and 2 equals 4. And it was clear to me that their math was never going to match mine as long as they controlled the numbers, since they're speaking in these kind of metaphoric responses. So I decided to make the number my favorite number. And that was 1, meaning that I'm the only one playing the string bass, and in these string bass, they'll have to call this 1, which happened to be me.
Now, where was that?
Cass Tech, a great school, by the way.
That's it, yeah. Who eventually changed their way of addressing you. You received an honor of some sort at Cass Tech?
In the general terms, I'm okay with them, you know.
Okay.
I've kind of gotten past looking to even the scores over the years. I'm trying to now spend more time being equal to the title of my book, looking for the right notes, and I don't have time for anything else right now.
Perfect. The reason why I actually went back to your beginnings was to address that you had written a song for your father, Friends. Yes?
Yes. along the way, you know, he's mm-hmm. always an important figure in my life, and I thought that it's time for me to have a song that requires an image to make the title work, and he's fit that picture exactly.
And his name was Lutheran Carter?
That's correct.
And your mother's name was Willie Carter?
Yes.
Did you write a song for her as well, with her in mind?
No, but sometimes any kind of a ballad that we get the right sound in reminds me of her. I do that all the time.
You've been involved in many musical excursions. What has been the motivation and the appeal for the choices of the excursions that you take?
Well, at some point I'd done an interview for a magazine, and they asked me who I wanted to play with next, since I was active at that time and making a lot of recordings and sessions. And I said, well, I have a list in my head of musicians who it compels me to play with them because of what they could bring to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think I treat every opportunity to play with someone who plays well like a free lesson, and I was due for a lesson from this person on my list who happened to be at this time Oscar Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point he ran across my list, and at that moment he needed a bass player to cover a couple of gigs in Canada, and so he called me to see if I was interested in getting his name off my list, and I said yes I am, and we worked it out.
Okay.
Wonderful man.
Nice. another pianist that you worked with, Randy Weston. How did you become part of the Uhuru Africa suite?
Well, I was working with Randy when I first came to New York, and I'm not sure how I got this gig with him, but we were at the Fast Spot, and it was at 3rd Avenue and 4th Street in the Village across from Cooper Union before they moved to 8th Street and 3rd Avenue. But at the time that that club was there, Randy was working there for almost 4 or 5 weeks in a row, which was really great for me because I got a chance to meet New York, meet some people, learn some libraries and stuff. And that along the way, Melville Liston, I think, who was a friend of his, who was a wonderful trombone player, had a recording session with maybe Creed Taylor or someone like the A&M Records, something like that. And Randy's band was, of course, the rhythm section of this wonderful arranging and wonderful big band guys that she had someone hired for this particular session. That time we were at the festival, we played opposite Ornette Coleman for 2 weeks, opposite the Jazz Dead for a week, opposite Kenny Dorman, an all-star band there. So for me, it was a wonderful welcome to New York, all the possibilities looking at me every night.
We'll be right back.
I understood that you were going to work with Art Blakey, but that didn't work out. What happened?
Well, it isn't that it worked out. We had an audition, and he felt that someone else we hired was equal to the job task. And as the offer came along, I thought that the offer to make the job wasn't really enough. I thought it was not a good financial settlement for me to join the band, so I became unavailable. And the person who we hired, the wonderful player, by the way, who I enjoyed playing with the band, ultimately joined the band.
Okay. There's one thing that I actually like about your work ethic. You have a work ethic. The fact that you, and I'm sure this is how you wound up with work, you're not strung out, you didn't do drugs, you were on time, and that's very admirable. Is that something that you teach in your classes when you started teaching?
Well, I teach a lot of things. That's mm-hmm. among the things I teach. Being a professional is a pretty big word with a lot of letters, and they all mean something to being a working musician. Successful is kind of a term that's difficult to quantify, but I kind of stress, for example, if the lesson starts at 9 o'clock, you can't walk in at 8:45 and tell me you're ready for the lesson. It just doesn't. That's not how good lessons get off to a good start, for example. Or if I give you an assignment that I expect you to cover, it's your responsibility to the lesson, not just to me, but to the assignment I give you, which I hope will make you be able to play it better. That's your responsibility. I try to explain to the students how responsible they are, not just the band leader or the band leader in the library, but they have a responsibility to prepare for the job, for example, to prepare for the music lesson, to look around and see who they can help along the way, whether they're a fellow student or a classmate, kind of a two-paragraph description of humanity for them. I never thought that showing up at the last minute, for example, for a gig and being the first one people see when the band starts walking on the bandstand was important to me. I thought it was important to me to get there so I could make sure my instrument still works, make sure the amp is still there, and in working order, I can kind of catch my breath after walking two blocks with the bass trying to park my car. Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to make it as comfortable for me to sound good as I can control. And I kind of stress that with my students as well.
And there's something as far as showing up earlier, working with Rudy Van Gelder, according to Finding the Right Notes, he indicated that in working with you, it was as working with a friend as opposed to an adversary. Is that an example of what you were just saying as far as getting things right before the job?
Rudy and I had a kind of a special relationship, which doesn't mean that it was special because we were friends. Rudy would take on the Saturday when he wasn't working, which would be like 6 months of Saturdays, I would go out there with my two sons, and they'd get in the corner and read a book, and Rudy would spend a couple hours each Saturday with me trying to figure out how best to record the bass. Not necessarily my bass. It was mine, of course, but how to record the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best microphone? What's the best location in the room? Do you need a rug under the bass? How close should the microphone be? This kind of scientific detail, which always interested me. And here's a person who is considered, rightfully so, the dean of recording engineers. And he's taken the time from his routine and recording schedule, which is bigger than mine, to sit down with this person and try to figure out how best not just to record my bass, I can record basses on other instruments and other bass players on other recording sessions he has. Other players who have different physical needs, who have different musical concepts, who have different sounds, who have different skill levels. And his job was to find out with this fellow scientist, me, can I make this recording process of the bass better? And what does it take to make that happen? And I enjoyed being a guinea pig. I learned so much about how that's possible. And as it turned out, we kind of came across some, at the time, kind of unique ways of how to record the bass, so it had a really big presence on records. And he was my dear friend.
Also reading the book, I noticed how, in laying out the book, Dan Hualet used different articles to tell your story. Did he also have conversations with you?
Well, absolutely. We talked until I didn't want to do any more, and I said, okay, I think that's fine enough for the day, and we'd do 2.5 hours, or depending on the topic and my events for the day, how busy I was, because I was still working all the time, and he was doing other writing for Downbeat and the other jazz magazines, so we didn't have all the time in the world. And, for example, when summertime rolled around, there's always festivals, and I'm always not home. And when we'd be on the same program, I'm coming in the door to the hotel, and he's going out to do an interview with someone else, so this wasn't that kind of constantly big amount of time. So when we got together, it was pretty intense and pretty substantial, and I would say I had enough, we'd just cut it off and do it again next time we could get together.
The instruments that you play acoustic bass, and you play a piccolo bass, and
yes,
you occasionally play electric bass.
Yes.
Bob Cranshaw had mentioned how you were not a fan of the electric bass.
But as the studio things in New York started to change, the Milt Hintons, the George Duviviers, the Ron Carters, the Richard Davis, all of a sudden we were all thrown into the bag of, because the people we were working for, the writers, everything started to be electric bass. Now, the guys who played electric bass, it was a field day for them because they were already accustomed to the instrument. But for us, it was a big change. And Ron did dates on electric bass, but he didn't like it. I mean, it just was not comfortable.
Is that true?
Well, that's probably a view that they assumed, because I don't play one. That was never my view of not a fan of it. What I was not a fan of was not having the time to practice enough to be as competitive with the electric bass community as Bob clearly was.
Got it. Okay.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in my bowls, name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is bassist, cellist, composer, bandleader, educator, and NEA jazz master, Ron Carter. As you can tell from the conversation, when I had spoken to Ron Carter, I had lost my voice. So it was just coming back. We had to delay our conversation. So I'm grateful that Ron Carter was able to spare some time for us. What you're listening to right now is Little Waltz from Piccolo. This is a 1999 milestone release from Ron Carter. Ron Carter on Piccolo bass, Kenny Barron on piano, Buster Williams on bass, and Ben Riley on drums. Before that, we heard Randy Weston's Infrane from Blue Moses. This is a 1972 CTI release. The personnel includes Randy Weston on electric piano, Ron Carter on bass, Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Grover Washington Jr. on tenor saxophone, and Billy Cobham on drums. As you know, since this is a CTI release, it has a personnel of thousands. Before that, we heard, also from Randy Weston, Fourth Movement, Kucheza Blues from Uhuru, Africa. This is a 1960 Roulette Records release. The personnel includes Randy Weston on piano and George DeVivier and Ron Carter sharing the bass chairs. Before that, we heard Friends, which was dedicated to Ron Carter's father. Ron Carter's Friends from 1993 EAU Blue Note Records recording. The personnel includes Ron Carter on big and piccolo bass. Yes, that's the language that they used. Hubert Laws on flute, Steve Kroon on percussion, Stephen Scott or Kenny Barron on piano. Before that, we heard Dorita from Will Calhoun's 2013 Life in This World release. That's on Motema Records. Will Calhoun on drums, Donald Harrison on alto saxophone, Ron Carter on bass, Mark Carey on piano. Before that, we heard Third Plane from Ron Carter, Herbie Hancock, and Tony Williams. That's the title track. This is a 1977 Milestone Records release. Ron Carter on acoustic bass, Herbie Hancock on piano, Tony Williams on drums. Before that, we heard from Jane Cortez to close out National Poetry Month. We'll be hearing another one from Jane Cortez toward the end of the program. This was titled Somewhere a Woman is Singing from Jane Cortez's Borders of Disorderly Time, her 2003 Bola Press release. Jane Cortez spoken word in duet with Ron Carter on bass. And we opened our program, of course, with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972, originally recorded in 1967. This is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams and more from Ron Carter and about as much music as we can squeeze in on Sugar in My Bowl right here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
What is a piccolo bass? What makes it different from an acoustic bass?
Well, it's the same acoustic instrument. It's a different size, different tuning. When I put together the first quartet with two basses, piano, and drums, I wanted an instrument that would sit me physically in front of the band, and it should be a different range of the instrument that would make me be able to play whatever I wanted to play outside of the range of the rhythm bass in the back of the band, this time Buster Williams. And so I had this friend of mine who I met through Richard Davis, mm-hmm. who was an instrument maker in New Jersey, who said, after we sat down for about 3 hours to tell him my description of what I thought I would need, not really knowing if it was possible, he would sit down and try to figure out what I wanted and try to make an instrument that would cover as much of my needs as he could probably figure out. So he did that, and to have it clearly distinctive from Buster Williams' bass, I call it a piccolo bass. It's tuned up like a cello, upside down. Top string is C, G, D, A, and the cello is top string A, D, G, C. But again, it was just enough out of the range of the bass I could play anywhere on the instrument, and so could Buster.
Nice.
And you hear our individual lines.
That's great.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 30th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show features bassist Ron Carter. He has an 80th birthday celebration coming up at the Blue Note this week through May 7th, and there will be different guests joining him each night. Now, let's get to this week's music listings. Speaking of bassists, Linda Mahon O's new Walk Against Wind release is our current Listen Here entry on our blog. You can stream the entire CD for a limited time. See the link on our website at sugarinmybowl.org, and that's sugar spelled S-U-G-A. And it's the last call for director John Scheinfeld's John Coltrane documentary film Chasing Train. It's held over at the IFC Center in Manhattan through May 2nd, and there's also a review of the film on our blog. Saxophonist David Murray leads a class struggle ensemble at the Village Vanguard from the 2nd through 7th with trombonist Craig Harris. Saxophonist Billy Harper is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from the 3rd through the 6th. Hammond B3 organ master Dr. Lonnie Smith leads a trio at Aaron Davis Hall on the City College of New York's Harlem campus on May 5th. Vocalists Dee Dee Bridgewater, Diane Reeves, and drummer Terry Lynn Carrington are all at the Abby Lincoln Tribute Concert at the Apollo Theater on the 6th. Looking a little further ahead, pianist Vijay Iyer leads his trio at the Village Vanguard from the 9th through the 14th. Guitarist Julian Lodge is at the Stone on the 11th through 12th in their new location at New School University's Glassbox Theater. Flutist Bobby Humphrey is at Ginny's Supper Club on the 12th. Finally, pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Small's on the 17th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And remember, sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website for details. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, May 14th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Thank you.
So how did it feel playing with one of the best ensembles in the history of this music, with Miles Davis?
Every night was a laboratory. We'd go to the gig. He would set up these different chemicals that they call them tunes in that days, you know, and we'd go to our corner in the laboratory and figure out what we want to assemble and get together in the middle of the room and see if they would either explode or not. And every night it was an experiment. We loved it. I loved it. For Wayne and George and Herbie and Tony, that we looked forward to coming to work every night because we didn't know what would happen, but it would be interesting.
On ESP in particular, speaking of songs for relatives, you had written a song for your son, Ron Jr., RJ.
Yes.
Did you also create a song for Miles?
R2M1. had a dog called Rover at some point, and Rover was completely in charge of him, so if I were keeping the score, it would be R2-M1.
Got it. Also, and this was another thing that made you a big rave for me, you were assigned an additional job, not only playing bass with the ensemble with Miles Davis, but you were the paymaster.
Well, you know, he kind of felt that I was, and again, I'm kind of supposing this is the case because we never discussed it. There was never any do you want to or how about if or I think you should. You just say, okay, you pay the band at the first gig, and tomorrow you check on the flights. And that's what the process for me and Miles for the 5 years I was with the band.
Once again, according to Finding the Right Notes, you spoke up. You were constantly speaking up when you first met Miles Davis. That's what sort of made your relationship different. But in this particular case, it was during the 1964 live performance at Lincoln Center, where the band was being volunteered to play, and the wages would be donated to Corps or SNCC or both, and you spoke up.
Well, I thought that was the thing to do. And again, I was already in the role of paymaster and schedule keeper, whatever you call those persons that do that. Mm-hmm. But I just thought that I was all for playing for a benefit. I understood the reasons behind raising funds for Corps and SNCC and people whose organizations had a view of a better place for African Americans. And I would have gladly volunteered my services. But I thought that was my place to volunteer my services, not the band leader, whoever he or she was.
Right.
And I just thought that wasn't fair. And I hate that word fair, but I thought that wasn't okay for him or anyone to assume that they knew my perspective on this particular benefit. The fact of the matter is, maybe I didn't like those people. Maybe I didn't want to play free for them. Mm. Maybe I should pay for a different price. Maybe I would ask for more money from me. The options were just too many to be concerned with. I just thought the best way to do this is by telling Miles that I think it's not fair for you to do this to me personally, but the band in general. But I'm only speaking for me. If you wish to do this and not pay us, I wish not to be here. In fact, I had headed toward the door. I wasn't going to play, man. I just didn't seem, I resented him thinking that it was okay to speak on my behalf, and I didn't like that. Today, if I have an issue, right now, the bane of my existence, and Miss Jones, is not getting the jazz community into the newspapers on a regular basis like they do the classical orchestra and the opera and the ballet. That upsets me. When I get people asking me, hey, man, how's jazz going to get better? I say, well, look at the daily newspaper. Pick up anyone, any day of the week, and how many jazz articles do you find in the arts section?
Rarely. There may be one in the Times on Friday. Maybe.
Yeah, but they review the orchestras the moment they leave town or the moment they arrive in town. For example, the New York Times has a heading that says, all the news are fit to print, I think it says.
Right.
And so I ask my audience, is this music fit to print, to write about? But before I say that, Ms. Jones, I ask the band, do they mind me saying this? Because I'm speaking, in this case, on their behalf, even though I'm not speaking for them. My people assume I'm speaking for their thoughts. And I don't want them to feel that that's the case until the band tells me they don't mind or please don't. And if they don't mind, I say it in a professional way. And if they think it's not quite their view, I don't say it. I think I owe them their respect and they owe me their respect. And I felt that Miles didn't respect me by thinking he could give our money, whatever money was, to a cause that he didn't know whether I agreed with or not.
Well, there was one recording that you had done with Miles, with the ensemble. Miles in the Sky, Paraphernalia in particular, where George Benson has a guest appearance with the ensemble. The exchange between the two of you is just incredible. I love it. I love that. Was there an active discussion about that exchange between you and George?
No, and I haven't heard the record, so I'm not quite sure what you're referring to other than George being there with the band, and we had such a good time playing with George. Anything he played was going to be perfect because George is such a fantastic guitar player. But I haven't heard the record since we made it, and I'm not sure what you're referring to, but I can assure you that we didn't work anything out that would make it sound like that.
Okay. It sounded great.
It was good enough for me.
Now, there's somebody else you worked with, Eric Dolphy. He was on your release as a leader, but you played with him before that. What was it like playing with him?
It was great. You know, we didn't make any jobs together, only at studio playing.
Okay.
Thank you.
he had a great view of the world. Mm-hmm. So everyone was okay, and everyone was okay. And we would talk about the philosophy of everybody can't be okay for some reason or other. That's just not how it works out. But he would practice all the time, and I would listen to him practice, and he would say, what do you think about that? I said, well, you've got to write notes, but you're playing sharp. And he would say, okay. So that kind of helped me out. Kind of commentary. When he first moved to New York, he didn't know how to cook, so my late wife would invite him over for dinner, and she'd show him how to make this meal and how to make that kind of breakfast, so he could at least kind of get through a week with not having to eat out in the street, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. He was a really a musically enthusiastic performer. He enjoyed playing. He practiced every day so he could play good every night, and I admired that.
And there's somebody else you played with, Ken McIntyre, later Maconda.
Yes.
Ken McIntyre.
He was out of Eric Dolphy's school of musical concepts, and I enjoyed playing with him, although he was still trying to find his voice when he passed away.
But he taught, just like you, at university. When did you start teaching?
Well, when I came to New York, I began teaching privately as I was teaching in the public school system. I was a substitute teacher for a year. And I came to New York, and I taught math, and I think maybe phys ed, maybe geography as a substitute teacher. But I was kind of always, as my arrival in New York, always kind of taking some students aside for, well, I call them scholarship students who didn't have any money, but I'd find stuff for them to do. Let's sort this music out, or let's go buy some music things to do so that they were kind of working for the lesson, although they had no funds to pay for it. Teaching is a very difficult thing to do, and the more you teach, the more you find out how much you have to learn about how to teach. And I'm enjoying that process as we speak today.
Well, you have been teaching at City College. When did you start that?
I retired in 2000 or so. So I first started teaching in 1985 or 86.
Okay.
John Lewis was originally that teacher. And as the Modern Jazz Quartet was reforming to go back on the road again, they wanted somebody to take John Lewis's slot should he decide to come back. Well, the MJQ became even more famous and even more successful when they came back to regroup. And John did not return to City College. So I stayed on in his slot and did some other courses.
There are a lot of people that I've run into that have thanked you for what they learned at City College. They're really singing your praises, your former students.
Well, I miss that aspect of teaching. I miss the school environment. I miss the classes. Right now I'm teaching one-on-one, which is fine for me. But I miss the interaction with students, their vocabulary, the slang that changes every week, it seems to me, and just that kind of skill level, for example, of communicating with them on a word level that they're already into. I miss that kind of communication skills that I developed for the 18 years I was teaching there, you know. But they're really nice kids, and I enjoyed them.
Well, you talk about the language that is used. There's a project that you did. I'm sort of skipping over some things, but there's a project that you did, Red Hot and Cool, Stolen Moments, and you recorded with a rapper, MC Solar, French.
Paris, 1994. Quand Dieu créa l'homme, tout était beau comme les yeux d'une nonne, un beau matin d'automne, puis elle croqua la pomme, donc s'additionne dans l'histoire de l'homme, les recherches de sérum. L'homme est comme un ange en danger, que les eaux du Gange veulent changer. L'argent de ce morceau aura pour utilité d'aider de Tanger à Angers un ange en danger. D'être courtois, tu te demandes pourquoi? Parce que ma cause est noble. Voilà, c'est grâce à l'héritage jazz que l'homme singe devient l'homme sage. J'ai l'âge de 10 ans quand je demande à ma maman pourquoi tant de mal dans le monde des grands. C'était cool à l'époque avec mon short et mes potes. Désormais, quand je suis croque, je pense aux spots sur les capotes. J'espère que cela va changer. Un ange est en danger. Je remercie mon sponsor, à savoir mon esprit et mon corps. L'homme, l'homme, que l'homme, l'homme, tout simplement Ron Carter. Pense à la descendance, à contrebasse, c'est un pacemaker. Hip-hop non-stop, plus jazz, pas naze. Live, pas sampé dans un disque d'occasion. Nous avons fait notre part, le ciel peut juger pour tenter de sauver un ange en danger. Un ange en danger.
Yes, he became very famous, by the way.
Yes, he did.
I did a review concert with him with Roy Hargrove maybe 4 years ago in Paris at the concert, and he'd grown up physically. He's kind of been really the nice gentleman that he always wanted to be, and he looks really great, and he's, I call it singing. He hates that word, but he's singing even better than before.
Oh, wonderful.
Good singer.
Yes.
And a good rapper, too, of course.
Yes. To go back, you had done commercials. You were a busy guy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any of them?
A couple of Coke commercials, a couple of automobile commercials, a couple of newspaper commercials. I was pretty busy at the time, and a couple of gasoline company commercials, the Exxon or Exo, Shell, whatever the commercials were. At the time in New York, all of us did commercials. There was so many to do, and they were always going on. Tours were going on 24 hours a day, and they're just another form of looking for the right notes, only 35 seconds to find the right notes.
Right.
You're going to somewhere else. I missed the camaraderie of those dates because the pressure was so great to go in there and play it right the first time around. I enjoyed honing my skills to be able to do that, and I missed the guys who I don't see anymore because the studios, in essence, of that level of performance don't exist anymore.
Right. And I think they first went to California as well. They stopped doing them in New York.
They're slowing out there, too, from what I hear. The whole concept of recording commercials just kind of changed, and we're all feeling and missing that part of the industry.
I actually heard something recently about people, they would like to have themes again for TV shows, because that's something else that's part of that work, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That session work. But that's something else that's also drying up. People aren't using themes.
Yeah, I'm sorry that that may be a hint of where we are right now with our inability to maintain focus more than 35 seconds.
To get back to recording, there was a period where right after you left Miles Davis's ensemble, you then started working at CTI, which was
an
extremely busy period.
Absolutely. I liked all those guys personally because they all were friends of mine. And to be able not to go out to Rudy Van Gelder's and have a chance to have the bass sound good on recording as we had worked so diligently for all those months on Saturday afternoons. And I had a chance to play with Freddie Hubbard and George Benson and Bob James and Herbie and Jackie Jeanette and Billy Cobb and Grover Washington and Ralph McDonald and Richard T. Didn't know I had a chance to play with these guys a couple of times a week was enough to make my month.
And you also had a recording as a leader on CTI Blues Farm.
I made several of leader records. Those records with CTI, I had a full complement of guys, Richard T, Roland Hanna, Hubert Loss. I mean, the record without those guys, it would have been not so good because they knew what I needed. And I loved playing with them, and I cherished those records because my friends saw what I needed, and they contributed to my needs, as I try to do when I play on anyone else's record. I try to find out what their needs are and how quickly can I find what that need is and can I put in a bass note to make that need have a life.
On CTI, you worked with Stanley Turrentine. I think that was one of your first.
Yeah, big record called Sugar.
Right.
Yeah, man. Somebody even put words to that. I heard the other day on the radio, four-piece vocal band had words to that. It's interesting. I had never heard that before.
And you did Rites of Spring with Hubert Laws.
Yeah, with Don Sobieski arrangements.
Yes, yes. And it sort of incorporated a fusion of European classical and jazz. So it said.
And it was a successful record for Hubert. It got him the notice he deserved, and it kind of brought him to another level of people saying, oh, that's Hubert Laws, because he really played great on that record.
And you even did something with Don Sobieski, Giant Box?
Yes, when Jackie and Roy, they're on there, and they were a wonderful singing duo that I miss terribly these days.
And tell me about Peaceful World. That was a release with the Rascals.
You know, those groups at the time, they were always looking for interesting backgrounds to do what they did. And when they were put together in an orchestra that needed an upright player, those guys, the Rascals, the young Rascals, I guess they were there, they had a pretty wide view of music in terms of who else was out there playing music as well other than them. And they knew my name from somewhere else. And I got a call that when I want to play in the orchestra. And said, yeah, give me the call. I want to meet those guys too. I want to see what do they do? How do they do what they do? How long does it take to get a record together for these guys? I was back then my scientist coat on, my lab coat on. I went to the laboratory. They were really nice. Young, I call them young kids because they were much younger than me. But they had a view of how music should sound to them. And I was impressed with that determination to get the song right as they wanted to sound. That was amazing to me.
Vocalists. How do you approach working with vocalists?
It depends on what they bring to the table. And my job is to make them want to call me back when the session is over for some other work. But to make that happen, it's easier for me if they bring something to the table. Carmen McRae, Shirley Horn, Sarah Vaughan, Roberta Flack, all those singers are wonderful piano players.
Ah.
And that helps me hear what they hear because they have a sense of the piano orchestra. Now, there are some singers who don't play piano, who also sing really good, and I enjoy them for a different reason. First of all, I like them with Sheila Jordan. She's a really improvisatory singer who doesn't use a piano in what she does. And she trusts what the bass player does to help her get to her right notes. But those four singers I mentioned before, Sarah and Carmen and Roberta, Blossom Dearie is another wonderful singer piano player. One of the things that makes my job easier is that their piano skills gives me a head start on what kind of note I can find to match the sound that they are comfortable with playing the piano.
Got it. Was Esther Phillips a pianist as well, or no?
No, she's a real great blues singer.
Yes.
Man. She can just sing all day, and she didn't need to get near a piano for me. She had a really great time. Little Esther, I used to call her.
Yes. There was one thing that you said about working with Tony Williams, or at least this was written in the book, Finding the Right Notes, that it was said that you would probably leave the ensemble if Tony Williams left because he played with you as opposed to playing over you. I'm paraphrasing.
Correct. And I'm very upset that he's not here because I can't show him how much better I've gotten in the past 20 years.
I saw you at Brick in Brooklyn with Danny Simmons. He
yes.
was reading poetry, and
yes.
you were. It was just the two of you, a duet. Have you recorded any of that kind of thing before?
You know, it's in the can for Blue Note now, and they're trying to do some editing now to see if we can get that disc to come out sometime in the fall.
Oh, wow.
He's a wonderful poet, and I had a great time playing with him. With Russell, my trio would play some accidental music, I call it, between songs and his poetry, and he and I would do some things together. But, you know, I did that stuff in the 60s. I was really subbing for Bill Lee, who was a wonderful bass player
yes.
composer, who was Spike Lee's dad.
Yes.
He was the folk singer's bass player's bass player back in the 60s.
Right.
And when he got too busy, he would call me to cover a job for him, and so I'd go play with Theodore Bikel or Leon Bibb or Josh White Jr., to name a couple of them. And I would be playing the kind of songs behind these poet singers as they did what they did, and I found out 40 years later I was on the right track at that time because I'm just kind of feeling my way along. I don't know what they need. I don't know the lyrics. I don't know the tunes. But they trusted my note choice, so I said I must be on the right track. And to kind of revisit that Manhattan Cafe Wah coffee house scene with Danny was a nice review of my history, and I enjoyed doing that.
Excellent.
Do you know that those sweet-talking string sets are strung-out weapons against random searches? Do you know that the orchestra seated in the F-hole of a bass will not play the security suite when confronted? Did I dream that the laughter from Bag's groove was still traveling on a billiard ball through space? What do I know about the wood that smokes its interior melody as it crosses over a jam session of tribal disputes? Is this the polished surface of a shade tree from Rufus? Today I'm spitting gasoline into a carburetor because Ray Brown just left town and it's too late to talk about the identity crisis within musical forces on the soundstage of capitalism. It's too late to talk about the minstrelsies. Do you know that the memorized patterns played by all the ensembles riding the back of jazz into the sunset of the showcase had to first come through muddy holes of muddy waters? Did I dream that the foaming, celebrating, temperature-changing, untrappable, unforgettable, warm, ether-throwing storm and beautiful sea of waves was the fabulous one bass hit basically called Janet? I hear the fullness of the forest on fingerboards of a blue Monday. Do you know the invisible circles of moisture-proof strums in the great riffing heart of this volcano? I'm telling you that a supersensitive gut on a quivering bow can rupture and become a permanent hiding place for agitated artists in the no parking, no standing zone of a funky hallway on the Atlantic shore. Do you hear the freedom of the sea?
And so you're saying that should be coming out later this year?
We're hoping by next Thanksgiving, because they're doing the editing now and getting the bass sound straight and putting the tracks in order. So hopefully we'll get the package with the nice cover art and the nice liner notes. So it'll be a nice package to present for the holidays.
Beautiful. Now I have a quick question, if that's okay. One more?
Sure. Absolutely.
There is this thing. I don't know what you call it, but there is a thing that you do where it sounds like you're bending the note with your string. What is that called?
G-L-I-S-S-A-N-D-O. Glissando.
Okay.
And you do more than one, this I, Glissando.
Uh-huh. I think that is so great. You're like the pro at that. It's just wonderful. I heard Christian McBride do it. I heard him last Tuesday do it. And he's getting there.
Okay. Now, I'm working at the Blue Note May 2 through 7.
Yes.
With a different band every night. And if you come by any night, you hear me do those for you.
Excellent.
They come by. One night is duo, one night is Vinnie Golson, one night is Roy Hargrove, one night is Javon Jackson, one night is Houston Person, one night is Arian Rosnes, one night is Donald Vega, one night is Lenny White. I mean, all these people I've listened to, I've recorded with all of them, and they're all my dear friends, and they've stopped their schedule to contribute one night to my one-week celebration at the Blue Note. So if you come by one night, you hear one of those notes.
I'm sure I will. Thank you so much, Ron
You're
Carter.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate you. Be well.
Love your voice, by the way.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. Our guest for this evening was Ron Carter, and what we're listening to right now is the Ron Carter Sextet from his 1999 Blue Note Records release, Ora Fo. Name of this recording is Obrigado. We have Ron Carter on bass, Houston Person on tenor saxophone, Bill Frizzell on guitar, Stephen Scott on piano, Peyton Crossley on drums, and our former Sugar guest Steve Kroon on percussion. We didn't get to talk about Ron Carter's love of Brazilian music, or his working with Jim Hall, or the varying other things I wanted to talk. He had me on the clock, but we tried. We did what we could. Before that, we heard the other selection from Jane Cortez, Beautiful Sea of Waves, from her 2003 Borders of Disorderly Time on Bola Press. Jane Cortez, spoken word, in duet with Ron Carter on acoustic bass. Before that, we heard Ron Carter from a compilation, Stolen Moments, Red, Hot, and Cool. This is a 1994 Verve Records release. It was part of a series of releases from Verve where some of the funds were donated towards AIDS research. This is titled, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, Honnage en Danger. This is MC Solar on spoken word, accompanied by Ron Carter on bass. Before that, we heard So What from Ken McIntyre. This is from a compilation, The Complete United Artists Sessions. This was originally recorded. So What was originally recorded in 1962. This is a 1997 Blue Note compilation. Ken McIntyre on alto saxophone and flute, Jackie Byard on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Ben Riley on drums. Before that, we heard Ron Carter's debut release as a leader, Rally, is the name of the selection from Where. This is a 1961 Prestige Records release. Ron Carter on bass, cello on others, Eric Dolphy on bass clarinet, alto saxophone, and flute, Mal Waldron on piano, George DeVivier on bass, and Charlie Persep on drums. Before that, we heard an excerpt from Paraphernalia. I would have loved to play the whole song, but we wouldn't have been able to play anything else. That's over 12 minutes. Miles Davis, Miles in the Sky, a 1968 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Ron Carter on acoustic bass, Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, Herbie Hancock on piano, Tony Williams on drums, and guest guitarist George Benson. Before that, we heard R2 M1 for Ron Carter's son, Miles. This is from one of Ron Carter's CTI releases, Blues Farm. It was released in 1973. Ron Carter on acoustic bass and piccolo bass, Hubert Laws on flute, Richard T. on electric piano, Ralph McDonald on percussion, Billy Cobham on drums, Sam Brown on electric guitar. Before that, we heard RJ for Ron Jr. It was written for Ron Jr. from Miles Davis's ESP. This is a 1965 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Ron Carter on acoustic bass, Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, Herbie Hancock on piano, and Tony Williams on drums. Before that, we heard Joshua from Miles Davis's Seven Steps to Heaven. This was the first recording after Ron Carter joined Miles Davis. This is a 1963 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Ron Carter, acoustic bass, George Coleman, tenor saxophone, Herbie Hancock, piano, Tony Williams, drums. And of course, before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. We will be back on the air on May 14th. The WBAI Spring Fund Drive starts tomorrow, so be as generous as you can. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.